podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Anfield Wrap. I'm your host, Mo Stewart, and I'm delighted to be joined by a Scouse sporting icon, a woman who competed at three Olympic Games over a 13-year senior career, collecting 11 major medals, including Olympic bronze at Rio in 2016. Not content with one stellar career, she's now setting the literary world on fire with her book, My Hidden Race, shortlisted for the William Hill Sports Book of the Year prize. Anyika Onora, welcome to the Anfield Wrap.
Thank you. What an intro. Gosh, I forget about I had all that in my career.
Trust me, I've been working on that for quite a while. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you.
Now, there's lots that I want to discuss from the book and from outside. And we will be delving deep into your Liverpool fandom. For those who can't tell, she is wearing her Liverpool shirt with pride.
Come on.
Which I'm actually really pleased about. Yeah, but yeah. First of all, congratulations on the nomination for the Sports Book Awards. Now, the awards was last week. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, you didn't win. But let's talk about the achievement of getting shortlisted in general. There was, what, 150 books or something like that that were under consideration, and you were in the top five books of the year?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. It is. It was a pretty big deal. I didn't really take it in as much until probably the day of. Like it was I was kind of nervous because, you know, when I've won medals in the past and when I've been in finals, it's usually been with three other women.
Yeah.
But like, this is just me. So it's nice to be recognized for my achievements single-handedly. Even though obviously there was a team behind me, like my agent, publicist, all of that. But like, this is like, I put my life on the line writing this book. So I am extremely proud of what I've achieved so far.
So were you aware of the list coming out, or was it something your publicist put you in for and they just said, oh, by the way, you've been nominated for this?
Do you know what is really weird? So like David, my agent, David Luxton, and Jonathan, who helped with the writing process, they were talking about the William Hill Sports Book of the Year ages ago. Like I'm talking 2020, when all of this was just like in its early phase.
Wow.
And I was like, what's that? I'm like, what is that? And they were like, oh, it's like the Oscars for the books. And I'm like, okay, cool. And they were like, can you imagine if you're nominated? I'm like, okay, like whatever, innit? I'm just like, let's take our time. Yeah, exactly. Let's baby steps. And then when the book was put in, it was then announced to be on the long list. Mm-hmm. So I was on the long list originally. So it was 15 books. And then I'm like, ooh, an hour on. And then I had to wait a month to see if I'd been shortlisted. But even to be longlisted out of like just under 160 books that had been entered was incredible. And then once, I think I was on a plane to Vegas, and the publishers, they called me in and they dropped me an email, and I was just like, are you messing? I've been shortlisted. Oh my gosh. Like I was like, oh, like, this is like the best birthday, pre-birthday trip ever, or pre-birthday news. So yeah. And then, yeah, my feet really haven't touched the ground, like anything with the book since it came out this summer. So, you know, I didn't win, but, you know, just to be there, just to be part of, you know, the top five books. I was the only woman. I was the only Black woman. Mm-hmm. You know, they were talking a lot about female. They want more female writers, more female authors. And, you know, although I didn't win, hopefully there'll be a whole load of female authors to come through, whether you're an athlete or not. It doesn't matter. I just want to see more of us in spaces like this, because the publishing world is a bit of a minefield.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I wanted to ask you about that, because like the nomination is just a start. Like you talk about it as being like the Oscars of the literary world, and you've literally been on what they call like an awards campaign. I've seen you everywhere brandishing this wonderful book, talking to what people all across the country. I mean, what's that been like?
Oh, weird. It's weird. It has been nice, but again, I'm so used to, you know, traveling and training when it comes to, you know, competition and like performance related, you know, everything to do with like winning races, performing at the highest level. But when it's pretty much just you, you're basically trying to sell yourself and you're trying to sell your story. But it has been really interesting. And, you know, so many people have just reached out. Mm-hmm. They've been so receptive towards, you know, the book since it's come out. Like, you don't need to know about me and my story in order to read the book.
Yeah.
You can literally just pick up on, you know, oh, I know that, or I know this, or oh, I can relate to this. Or, you know, I want everyone to just realize that Doesn't matter who you are, what walk of life it is. Yes, it's talking from my experiences in and outside the sport, but I just wanted to tell a damn good story. Yeah. And I think I've done that.
Oh, you definitely have done that. Honestly, like I texted you after I just picked it up and said, there's a few times I actually had to put the book down and go, what? What is this?
Yeah.
But okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about the title as well, because mm-hmm. like my hidden race, obviously it might relate in some respects to your Hidden Greatness podcast, which yes. is also brilliant, by the way.
Thank you.
But there's quite a few meanings within just the three words of that title, isn't mm-hmm. it? So it's almost like the perfect encapsulation of your whole story, like you say, not just the athletics.
Yeah. So the title itself, it came about through a lot of brainstorming. We had like so many different ideas of what to call the book. But with my hidden race, it sits so well because there was a lot of stuff that I was dealing with on the track. Like, you know, you're trying to perform, you're trying to, you know, make finals, you're trying to win medals and, you know, head towards greatness and all of that good stuff. But behind that, there's a lot of stuff that I was dealing with internally that I didn't feel like I could tell anyone. Mm-hmm. I was going through so many traumatic experiences, you know, consistently year after year after year. Whereas the general public, when they see me on the start line, whether it's in Olympics, Commonwealth, whatever, or even at the British Trials, all they'd see is just Annika. Mm-hmm. She's like, oh, she's going to win the race or she's going to finish top two. And that was pretty much how it was, whereas I was actually dealing with a lot. So, yeah, there's a message behind the title, and hopefully I've been able to have people understand that with mm-hmm. the content of the book.
It's funny you talk about the kind of the appearance of only every showing up every champ sort of thing, and what we as the outside world get to see, because that's my main memory of you, is that literally rain or shine, champs in, champs out, you and Phil Jones standing there dissecting the race.
Good old Phil.
And you were one of the few people whose personality always was able to shine through, I thought, in that. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because like you say, there's so much that goes on behind the scenes, and we only really see the winners, the mm-hmm. podium makers. There's so many athletes who don't get to that stage, who are just grafting just as hard. And yeah. I mean, you touch on some of the hardships of being a professional athlete within the book. And again, do you think this is something that we as a general public should be more aware of?
Yeah, definitely. You know, like in the context of football, for example, football players get paid a huge amount of money, as we know, but that's also business.
Yeah.
Like, that can't be helped. Like, people scream and shout and say, oh, footballers should be, you know, you should be able to do this. And, you're only training for a couple of hours. But if you understand the logistics of what they've taken to get there, don't make out like they don't deserve that money. Mm-hmm. Also, that is not their fault, because it's just the nature of football. And it's funny because, like, me and my teammates, we talk about like the amount of money that's in football compared to track and field. But then people would lose their minds if they knew how much NFL get played, NBA play, NBL, all those big American sports. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just crazy. But, you know, people don't really understand what high level athletes go through. So hopefully, to an extent, I've been able to, you know, share mm-hmm. that and kind of lift the lid on it.
I think so. And I mean, even as someone like me who feels like they're quite empathetic to the world of athletes and who knows a little bit about it, there's still some parts of it I found quite shocking. Mm-hmm. But talking about the actual catalyst for writing the book itself. Now, obviously, when people get to the end of a long career, it's kind of natural to kind of take stock a little bit. But obviously, having read the book, anyone who has read the book will know that there's a lot of big issues tackled within it, and it must have been quite hard for you to get it out. Was there a bit of trepidation about being so open with these things that you've kind of kept it hidden for so long?
Oh, definitely. I was like, do I want to talk about all this stuff? Do I want to, you know, speak about it? Do I want to be open about it? And one of the books that I was always influenced by was, Andre Agassi's book, Open. Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorite books ever. I've read that so many times. And you know, again, he there's so many stories. He leaves you with your mouth open the whole time, hence why it's called Open. But also, a lot of the stuff that he did and he spoke about in his career, I can relate to. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you either tell your story or you don't. So I didn't want to leave anything out. I just wanted to tell my story. And, you know, however people take it, they take it. Like, at the end of the day, that was my reality. Mm-hmm. And it may be hard for people to grasp, because again, person that they know me to be, you know, certain type of way, but they had no idea I was dealing with so many things. So it's like you either tell a good story or you have someone else write it for you. That's not going to be a true depiction of who you are. So I was like, no, I'm not leaving anything out.
No, well, you can definitely reckon, anyone who knows anything about you will recognise you throughout this book. I mean, even the throwing eggs at someone's house, the dingle. that sounded like Anika to me. But there was an interview that you did with Don McRae, who helped you throughout this book when you were still an athlete back in 2017, that kind of touched on some of the hardships you'd been through in terms of illness and injury at that point. Mm-hmm. How influential was that, and the way that he was able to kind of translate your thoughts into that article in terms of thinking, okay, well, this really can be something?
Yeah, massively. That one interview pretty much set me up for what was to come, but I had no idea what that would be. Mm-hmm. And I'd known of Don prior to that interview, and you know, I'd heard so much about him. So when we did that interview in the Bahamas doing this crazy interview, and you know, the phone kept cutting out, and I'm like, I've done so many interviews in the past, I'm thinking there's no way he's gonna get everything word for word, because it was down a crackly line. You'd think we were back in the 80s the way it was. but no, he got it word for word. And I hadn't met him at that point. And he said, one of the things he said to me off the back of it, once the article had been released, he said, you know, I can tell there's a lot more to you. I can tell, like, we've only just scratched the surface. Like, this is just one part, because the whole point of the interview was for him to tell my story about how I contracted malaria before the Olympic Games. So yeah, we just started an amazing friendship since then. And yeah, he helped me put all of this together.
His journalistic instincts were going off of me. Like, he knew he was sitting on an absolute goldmine.
Yeah, he did.
But no, thanks to Don for helping bring this to life, definitely. So let's talk a little bit about your career in general. Now, in the book, you mentioned kind of like the catalyst for falling in love with athletics being like the Sydney Olympics in 2000, an Olympics that I remember very well as well. But in reality, the Olympics haven't always been that kind to you, if you think about it. No. I mean, we had Beijing, where you unfortunately missed out on the final selection for the big race. And then there was 2012 that didn't quite go as planned when you were still in the process of mourning your father. But then finally it came together at Rio. Just about. And I mean, it almost didn't. We've touched. We're going to go deeper into the malaria section later. Don't worry. But did you think, when you got to Rio, did you really think that you might have some kind of Olympic curse on you? And having broken that curse, do you feel like that was kind of like the payoff for those previous disappointments?
Yeah and no. So I wouldn't say an Olympic curse per se, but I knew Rio would potentially have been my last Olympics. But because I was on a high from, you know, I'd switched events within 2 years and I was running crazy times, running really well, winning medals. So within 2 years, I'd won 3 out of the 4 medals, and the Olympic one was the elusive one. So just the way that happened in 2016 was just an absolutely crazy year. You know, aside from malaria, I almost didn't get selected because of the selection policy and the awful race I did at the Olympic trials. I had, honestly, when I look back at all my races, I'm like, gosh, I was like, every Olympic trials, I never ran well at all. But then once I'd, you know, had that race off with Christine, you know, even though at the end of the day, I still felt like I should have been selected, but Christine's still my friend. One of my good friends in the sport, and I'm glad she, you know, between the two of us, I'm glad it was her who got it. And then, you know, once I got the call to say, okay, you're still going as part of the relay team, as disappointed as I was, I knew this is going to probably be the only opportunity you're going to get to win an Olympic medal, because the way the team had progressed over the last couple of years, and to be part of that, and to be, you know, part of that success. I just remember telling the girls before we went into the call room that, you know, just leave whatever we've got behind, like, just focus on this one race. We may never get this opportunity again. And, you know, we didn't. It's now or never. Yeah. It's now or never. And, you know, we all got that opportunity to stand on the podium, and I was, yeah, elated with the outcome.
That's the movie moment though, really. Isn't it? I mean, there are so many parts of the story that make me think, seriously, someone's making this. Like, this has to be a story. And the storyline between you and Christine is a really, like, if it was a movie, that would be like one of the main central themes, because the two of you came through the ranks together. Yeah. You are both really important in each other's careers as they've gone through. And then you had this moment where it was one or the other. And considering you've kind of came into her event as well.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, amen. First of all, let me ask about that. Was it something that she encouraged you to, or was she a little bit like, oh, really? You're coming into my lane now?
No, not even. It happened by mistake. It literally happened by mistake. My previous coach, who I was working with at the time, you know, he basically told me that because, you know, I was still focused on 100 and 200 meters. Mm-hmm. He said, I can honestly only give you another 2-3 years competing at the 200 meters at best. You'll probably make finals or get run, or maybe run like, I don't know, how quick did he say? Because at the time, my personal best was 22.6. So he could probably do, he said 22.4, 22.3 high at best. But he said, I definitely couldn't get you to run 21 or 22.1. And I was like, okay, that's cool. Mm-hmm. He said, but what I can get you to do, because you've got a lot of strength, power, speed, we can shift that longevity to the 400. So initially I was like, absolutely not. Like,
double your workload.
I'm like, why would I want to do that? But, you know, the way he sold it to me, he's like, you wouldn't have to do, it wouldn't be that much of a jump workout-wise than what I'm already doing, because of, you know, I was one of the few in the world who had a lot of speed. Like, mm-hmm. I was running 22 seconds over 200 meters. You just need to run, you know, on average 50 point low, you know, to split in a relay or to run the individual time. And, you know, it worked out pretty well. just about.
Yeah, he might have been onto something.
Yeah,
there.
He was.
But I mean, talking about the stuff between you and Christine, and mm-hmm. in general, the idea of the mix between being an individual sport, but then having to come together as a team in the relay, this is something that I'm really fascinated about, because for most other sports, it's one or the other. You're yeah. either an individual, like a tennis player, a snooker player, whatever, mm-hmm. or you're in a team, a cricket team, rugby team, football team. You get to do both.
Yeah.
Now, the dynamic within the group must be such a hard thing to manage. How important is that dynamic to the overall thing, regardless of actual ability of the athletes?
Oh, massively. You have to be able to buy into it. If you don't buy into it, how are you going to succeed? So, you know, you can't be egotistical. You can't be, you know, all high and mighty. I deserve to run this leg. I deserve to run that leg. It's what you guys see is the final outcome, whether we win a medal or not. But it actually takes years, if not, you know, it takes months, if not years, to get to that level mm-hmm. consistently. And then once you're there, that's when everyone wants to buy into it. So start, like, we're in December now. So we would have regular relay meetings at either Loughborough or London, mainly in Loughborough. So everyone, doesn't matter where you're based, Scotland, London, Wales, whatever, mm-hmm. everyone would meet up and we'd have weekends away. And there would either be training sessions involved where we'd just train together, or there would be meetings with the relay coaches, you know, setting the goals for the next mm-hmm. year, looking at where we went wrong or where, you know, where we lost out on our vital opportunities, but also assessing the season as a whole and as a team. How can we do that? How can we get better? So at the time, we were always neck and neck with Jamaica, USA. It was always them, and everyone else is fighting for bronze. Mm-hmm. And that was how it was in my era. So it was like, okay, well, how can we shift that? How can we compete with USA? How can we, is there any chance or possibility that we could get up there? So yeah, there was a lot involved, and I think because everyone bought into it, who doesn't want to buy into success? You know, and it also forces you to step up, because mm-hmm. you don't want to get left off the team. You don't want to have a bad race. You don't want to have the relay coaches tell you, oh, you ran a really bad leg, so we're going to go with a different option. That's not what you want. He wants to watch a teammate win a medal on the podium.
But that's a strange thing, though, isn't it? Because even disregarding the fact that a relay squad is normally at least 5 or 6 athletes as opposed to just the 4 who do the running, if you are just taking the 4, in the individual spots, there's 3.
Yeah.
So one person is always going to miss out.
Always.
So you can look at it and say, well, if I missed out, oh, well, at least we're going to have a strong relay squad. Mm-hmm. But I mean, as I say, the fact that you guys have been a team for so long, that kind of, I imagine over time it gets easier to deal with those kind of things.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. You know, the team, there was moments even when I was on the team where I wasn't part of the strike four. I wasn't, you know, I'd run the heat, but then I'd be taken out for the final. It didn't happen very often, but it definitely happened on a few occurrences. But, you know, I trust the girls. The girls trusted me to do my job. And it was the same with the relay coaches as well. But yeah, there was definitely some nerve-wracking moments. You know, I talk about it in the book. Mm-hmm. Like the day of selection for that Olympic one was just, the anxiety is next level. So what they did, I don't know if they do it anymore, but...
Sorry, go for it.
So what they would do in the morning was they would select the team on the morning of competition. So either the heat, day of the heat, or the day of the final. And they would do that purposely. So we would be left tossing and turning the night before. We weren't allowed to get a good night's rest. We weren't allowed to get a good night's rest and a good night's sleep. We just had to go with the flow. And, you know, when you walk in the room, everyone's silent. You can hear a pin drop. You can't hear a pin drop. And then, yeah, and then you could tell there's a lot of anxiety because it's like, well, some people should be expected to be selected, but then, you know, there might be like a curveball that they throw in there. So you, and also as well, you kind of black out for a moment when they announce the team, because you're here, you're waiting for your name, Annika, just focus on that, focus on Annika. And then it's like, and then they'll say like, Christine, Annika, Ailey, and I'm, okay, so did he say my name? Did he say, did he say my name? I'm like, wait, okay, let's replay that back in the head. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, he did.
just look at everyone's faces. If there's someone looking upset, then he's never said my name.
Exactly.
So. But the relationships between yourself and the coaches and the administrators, I mean, some of the stuff regarding that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I want to touch on that a little bit now then. I've always been a little bit conflicted, particularly around the funding system, in terms of, I understand the idea of rewarding people who do well, mm-hmm. but the way that those who have struggles, who've been previously good, or who are still trying to make their way and maybe have a bad year or a bad injury, and suddenly their legs are cut off from beneath them.
Literally.
There's a lot of talk between the love of the sport, mm-hmm. for the athletes who are doing it, but then the roadblocks that are seemingly put in their way by the people who are supposed to be helping. Again, is this something that you think that us as a public should probably be more aware of?
Oh, definitely. If you didn't know, now you know. Yeah. I've definitely spoken about it. You know, I open up with, you know, in the beginning about, you know, the day of that, when we literally about to run the most important race of my career, which is the Olympics, and how, you know, one of the senior leaders of the team said there's X amount of money, you know, expletives, all this profanity on the line. And you're like, whoa, you know, it's shocking because people don't understand what we went through as athletes in order to retain our funding. Mm-hmm. So it's not the same as a 9-to-5 job, because with a 9-to-5 job, you're always going to get security. Or you get promoted, or you can move on to the next gig or next job, whatever you want to do. But everything is based on your physical performance. It's based on your body. So if you have a bad race, you can't afford to have that.
No.
Because you potentially lose your funding, potentially lose sponsors, your endorsements, like everything's on the line. And your security blanket, it slowly but surely like goes if you just have a bad race, if you have a bad year, if you have a bad season. So with the funding system itself, the way it's set up, it's not nice. It is what it is. I don't know personally what the answer would be. It's down to the powers that be. You know, UK Sport pretty much, you know, hold the purse strings in terms of how the money's distributed. But I think when I was competing, it was extremely tough because I was on and off funding my whole career. So I never had any handouts. I had to literally work so hard in order to get on funding. And then the hardest thing when you're off funding is getting back on.
Yeah.
That's like, it's retaining it is part of the job, But getting back on is so much harder because they can also look for reasons to not put you on, regardless of how you performed. And I went through that several times during my career.
And do you get to a point where the getting of funding becomes almost not a bigger goal, but a more important goal than the championships, the medals, the things that you're in it for?
Oh, no, I never did it for money. I mean, no, because there's no money in track and field. If we're going to be, if you want the tea, if you want the real tea, there is no money in athletics. There was before, like 10 years ago, 12 years ago, you could earn a decent paycheck. But as after every Olympic cycle, there's just less money. There's less money in the sport. There's less, you're receiving less money as part of your shoe contract. Yes, we're in a position, some of us are in a position where we are on funding, but that's just to pay bills. That's just to make sure like you can keep a roof over your head, make sure that like you're covered with your medical expenses, warm weather training and all of that. But again, if you don't have that, which I haven't been in, it's rough. It is rough out there. But if you're in the 1%, maybe, I don't know, maybe 1% is a bit harsh now. If you're in the 0.1% or maybe 0.5%, percentage of people who are the Usain Bolts, the Mo Farahs, Alison Felix, you're all good, but the rest of us are out here striving. And, you know, you can have all the medals in the world. It doesn't mean that you're not going to be broke.
No. And almost it becomes harder when you've got those medals and you're still broke.
Yeah, yeah.
I can imagine. Now, obviously, you said you've been on and off funding throughout your career and you've had lots of different jobs to kind of like help you along. So some stranger than others, some of the job offers that so I'm gonna make you talk about it. You should have known it was coming.
I forgot about that.
Oh yeah, there was when you were spending time in London, you were I think propositioned is probably the right word, isn't it? For a very certain kind of phone job.
Yes, for a very, very certain kind of phone job. So when I moved to London, I was doing different jobs. I had so many jobs over the 4 years that I lived there. But one thing I think scouts are really good at doing is just talking. I think we're really good at talking. So I used to work in various call centers. I was one of the people who used to sell you magazines like Cosmopolitan, GQ, all of that. Like sell you magazines, like get your prescription for like £3 for like the first 3 months and then £6 for the next 6 months. That was me. I also sold, what else did I sell? Electrical goods. What was the other one? Like TV broadband deals. I would do that. And then, yeah, one day, I was on the phone to my friend and I was telling her about, you know, the hardships of London. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, I hate not like having enough money. And like the job's good, but you know, because I had to manage my training schedule plus my work schedule, it was just like, ugh, like London was killing me. And there was a lady who was on the same carriage as me and she overheard the conversation. And I always feel weird about people listening on your calls because you think, well, are they listening or are they just there because they're there? But I could tell she was actually listening to conversation. So I got up and moved carriages and like this lady followed me and I was like, what's going on? And then as I got off the platform, she also got off the train as well. And I came off the phone because if I needed to bolt.
I was going to say, have you got your keys in your hand?
I was ready to, in case I got jumped, oh, you don't want to jump me. Like an athlete, are you okay? So yeah, she basically stopped to talk to me and she's like, hi, I couldn't help but overhear, you know, that you're going through some financial difficulty right now and you have an amazing voice, like her voice, I just remember it being so softly spoken. And she said, so I've got a proposition for you in terms of a new job. She's like, do you currently work in an office, you say, like a call center? And I'm like, yeah, I do actually. She's like, yeah, well, this is very, very similar to that. She's like, you can actually work from home. So this is work from home before work from home was a thing. Yeah. And I'm like, no way, really? And then she said, you know, it starts at £80 an hour. I'm like, what? And this is, I was like young at the time. I was like, are you messing? Like, am I being scammed right now? Like, what is this? And she's like, no. I was like, we're just a very unique company. And, you know, it's very niche in terms of what we do and how we deliver to our clients. So when she said clients, I was like, that was a bit triggering. But, you know, I didn't think anything of it. And then she said, She said, yeah, you got a really good voice. She's like, I can tell by your voice, you're very good with customers. You know, you're very well spoken. So I was like, thank you. Like, listen to all these compliments that she's given me. And then she said, yeah, so the majority of the clients that you'll be speaking to will be men. And I was like, oh, okay. I'm like, what, you don't get no female like women calling? Because obviously when I've worked in call centers, it's both men and women. And she's like, no, the majority of the callers will be men. So I was like, okay. And she's like, yeah, you will be speaking to them in a certain way. I'm like, a certain way?
Here we go.
And she's like, yeah, but you know, there's nothing to be afraid of, to not be scared of. So I'm like, okay. And in my head, I'm just thinking £80 an hour. And then she said, you know, after a while, after the probation period, you get like £250 an hour. And I'm thinking, this is too good to be true. And then she's like, I've got a script here that you may want to read. You know, don't be alarmed by any of the words if it's new. Because I'm thinking, I also studied English as well. So I'm thinking, I can pronounce words. How hard can it be? When she gave me the script, I was like, what? It was like, it literally said in brackets, speak sultry, in a sultry voice, sultry tone.
Wow.
And it would be like, hey there, how are you? Hi, how are you doing today? Hi, Gary, can I call you Gary? All of this. And then she, basically, it was a sex line. And she really wanted me to join the girls and to join her, you know, establishment. And she gave me her card and I was very skeptical about it and I couldn't find anything on Google. And she was like, it was registered under something else. Yeah, uh-huh. It was kind of weird in terms of how I found it because she gave me the address and she gave me her contact details because she was like, she was adamant that she wanted me because she's like, yeah, I've got no girls from up north in your voice and we really need to add, you'd be a great addition to the team. And I got the card and I was desperate to call when I got home, but I just burnt it.
I mean, based on that little example you gave me, you'd have been on 250 in no time.
No, I'm worth a lot more now.
Although, the problem is, though, I can see, aside from obviously the fact that the parents probably disown you.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, right, they wouldn't really know. They wouldn't know, well, I'm just saying.
I mean, this was going to be my second point, because, like, you do have a very distinctive voice. So it wouldn't be beyond the realms of possibility for someone to be sitting on their sofa enjoying the coverage of the Olympic Games and suddenly they sit bolt upright and they recognise your voice and a cold sweat covers up.
That's on them, not me.
Hey, takes all kinds, honestly. But I mean, again, this kind of just shows exactly all of the parts, all of the things that have happened to you in your life and your career and how they've kind of added up to the point mm-hmm. where you were able to get to. So I want to touch on the traumatic incident of the nearly dying.
Yeah, let's
because I mean, reading it in the book is painful.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no idea how it must have actually felt. Like, I mean, seriously, go through like the bed of ice.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Your mum reading you prayers over the phone. Gosh. I mean, I imagine when you came to write the book, those parts were quite easy to write. Those memories were quite vivid.
Yeah, they were. But, you know, I kind of remember everything. I just do. I had my training diary. I also had my normal diary. And because we go off the same routine every year, you know, you're either in South Africa in January or you're in Florida in the spring, you know, warm weather training. Or you're in Florida again in the winter time. So, or I'm at home in Loughborough during this period of time. Mm-hmm. So I kind of know where I was for most of the year. So it wasn't extremely vivid, no, but I just remember, you know, going through the whole writing process and having to relive it was hard. Having to speak to Jonathan, God bless him, he went through so much. He relived the trauma with me. He was right there with me, just with the whole writing process. But yeah, it was definitely rough. Like to this day, I don't even know how I contracted malaria. I don't know. Like, how could I be so, I've been so reckless. How did I let this happen? You know, was it my fault or mm-hmm. was it, you know, the mistake of like leaving the doors open or whatever? But yeah, it nearly killed me. It nearly did.
And yet It didn't stop you.
No, thankfully. But, you know, even when you said then with the bed of ice, I literally just got like a shiver down my spine because I don't even, like, that was traumatic in itself.
I mean, obviously, after that, I'm imagining you'd have gotten a few ice baths as part of your recovery.
Oh, yeah. This was different because you're trying to fix your temperature. My temperature was at like 38, 39 at this point. You're in pain. Like, you're in physical pain. You feel like you can't breathe. Your body's just gone into shock. And then add to shock, the nurse has just gone, oh, I'm just going to throw like bags and bags and bags of ice on your body to keep your temperature down. And yeah, that was like, yeah, super traumatic.
And within that, you were somehow having to try and think about resuming career.
Yeah.
You mentioned kind of dealing with the pain and using some of the kind of training methods, as in like breaking it down into small bits. Mm-hmm. How much do you think having that regime and that discipline of training and generally just being used to being in pain from being an athlete actually helps you through that period?
Oh, massively, massively. It was so easy. I could have just been in the hospital and then just not moved and just been like, oh, I'm just going to live the life of Riley and just wait to see what the outcome is and, you know, just focus on my recovery and rest. But I couldn't because the big one was coming in 10 months' time and I had to put myself in contention. And, you know, I purposely chose not to tell people that I contracted malaria. I only told a handful of people, like some of my training partners. Obviously, my coach knew, the federation knew, but I just wanted to keep it in-house. Because I just don't like people knowing certain things. And I don't want the whole sympathy thing. Oh, you're okay, Annika. And is there anything we can get you? I'm like, no, tell me what I need to do.
Yes.
How are we going to fix this? How long is it going to take to recover? So when I was, you know, in the hospital doing laps, per se, with me little, what do you call the drip thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was with that, just doing laps around the ward. I wasn't even allowed out the ward until after like day 4 as well. So I was bed bound for the whole time. It was I was like literally between the bathroom and my bed because I couldn't move physically. I was in pain, but I knew I needed to start moving around and gaining some sort of mobility back. So, whew, what a time.
So how did people react, like fellow athletes react firstly when you told them what you had been through? Surely they must have been like astounded.
Yeah, they were. So the article that Don wrote was basically the focus of that.
Like, and that was when the first time that they knew?
Yeah, in 20... So this was April, May 2017. So it was funny because I did the interview with Don in Bahamas and we were there for the World Relays. Mm-hmm. And we did it on like a Wednesday or Thursday. And he said, oh, the article will come out like at the weekend or early next week. So I was like, okay, fine, whatever. Because I was just focused on the competition of being in Bahamas. I completely forgot about the interview. And then on the Monday morning, we flew back to Florida to continue our training, warm weather training sessions. And when we landed, everyone was saying, Annika, what's this? So everyone got the phones out and, you know, they were like, yeah, this article, that article. It was all shared amongst them. And they were like, what do you mean? Me, I ran away. I was like, bye, see ya. Because I hadn't read it. I just literally forgot about it. And then when I got home that night, back to Bradenton, I read it and I was like, oh, this is incredible. Like, he actually wrote it exactly how I wanted it to be told. And a lot of the athletes reached out, and you know, the ones who were there with us in Florida as well, they were just like, wow, you went through so much, and you know, we're so proud of you. We're so glad that you're here with us today.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine, like you say, in terms of kind of just being focused on yourself and trying to get to the point you want to be, it makes it easier to kind of block those same things out and to keep them to yourself. But obviously, at the point when you are releasing some of these things and getting that reaction, it must be quite nice to be able to say, okay, well, I didn't want to tell them, but if I had told them, it probably still would have been okay.
Yeah, I think it would. I just think initially it's just very scary to tell your story and to be open about certain things, because these are the people who you're surrounded with day in, day out, or year in, year out. And I remember when I was in Shanghai for the Diamond League, and there was there's a US athlete, David Oliver, and he, you know, you see different athletes on the circuit and you'd know, you just say, hi, how are you? What's up? You know, da 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 da. You see them just during the whole year. And I remember warming up before the race, and I just remember Dio, that's what you called him, Dio. I was like, Dio just kept looking my way, and I'm thinking, gosh, am I in his way? Like, have I stepped over one of his hurdles? You know, because he's so big, he's massive, you can't miss him. And I remember before I was walking to the call room after my warm up, he ran up to me and he was like, Annika, and I'm like, what? I was like, gosh, what have I done? He's like, no, I just wanted to say, I read your article. I heard about what happened. He's like, man, you caught malaria. I was like, yeah, Dio. And, you know, he was just like, you know, I'm so glad that you survived it. Like, it's an incredible story. Like, you're just a fierce woman. Like, congrats on everything. And I'm like, wow. Because I, you know, you just don't always think about the impact that you've had in sharing your story. Because again, it's not like we do a 9-to-5 job where we can just recover at home, you know, holiday pay, sick pay. There's none of that.
No.
Like, there's literally none of that. So, like, the fact that someone like Dio can read my article, read about my story, and it's been pretty much the same with the book as well.
Yeah.
Like, just the reaction from people, just reaching out, sending DMs, emails, they can, you know, relate to some of the things I've gone through. So...
Yeah, what I think lots of people, even someone like me who's an outsider coming into the city, the bits where you're talking about Liverpool, particularly the early days, as I mentioned, like Dingle, but also Wavertree. Like, funny story, actually. I live around the corner from the Wavertree athletics track.
Oh, really?
I walk past it every day.
Oh, look at you.
And I think about you as a young kid starting your journey there and thinking about other kids starting their journey there. And I mean, it must be the same. I mean, for me, there's obviously different parts that you mentioned in the book that I kind of go through. And when I'm walking around, I see them and I think they remind me. Unfortunately, the Moat House Hotel's not around anymore.
Oh, good old Moat House.
But do you do the same? Obviously, when you walk around, how are you? I mean, how do you feel when you see the track now, when you go back to like places that you used to grow up and stuff?
It's so weird. First of all, Liverpool as a city has changed so much. Didn't I just tell you I couldn't find this building?
Yes.
I was like, where is this? And then, yeah, just going down like the Mystery. I never used to go down the Mystery because I was literally always on the track. So like I remember walking through the park, which is a Mystery, at the back of the track. And I'm thinking, is this what it looks like? I'd never always, because when I'm starting the 300s at the track, I'm starting at the back, on the back straight. So I would always get people watching or shouting, go on, go on. Or, you know, I'm in the middle of recovery and I'm just like, can you just shut up, please? I'm trying to recover, I've got lactic. So it's weird from, you know, look, now looking from the other side. But, you know, it is so good to be back in Liverpool. I never thought that I would move back, even if it is for a short amount of time. But I have missed being home. I've missed camaraderie. And Scousers are just great people. Like, it doesn't matter where I am in the world. People are like, oh my gosh, are you from Liverpool? Or if they, if they're not aware of where I am, they're like, where I'm from, I'd just tell them, oh, do you know, like Liverpool Football Club? They're like, oh my gosh, like Liverpool? Like, literally anywhere in the world, people get so excited. So I'm always, like, super proud to be from this city.
I love that. I love that. I mean, I have very similar situations. Like, some of my family are from Eastern Europe. And the only English words they know are football. I spent like 10 minutes talking about Steven Gerrard at their wedding.
Gosh. Funny.
But I mean, obviously, Liverpool is a big part of where you're from and who you are. But there's only half, or not even half, is another part of where you are. Obviously, the Nigerian heritage and that kind of dual lives, that dual worlds kind of come up a lot through the book. And your identity within kind of like a Nigerian family and the Nigerian community within the outer community of Liverpool.
Yeah.
And the feeling, like there's some, I think there's a line you mentioned in the book where it's like inside the house, physically it's Liverpool, but it's actually spiritually like Nigeria.
Yeah.
And did you find it hard to kind of reconcile those two, kind of the Scouseness and the Nigerian life? And how long did it take if you did?
Oh, I mean, I'm still going through it now. It doesn't stop. But I think you learn to recognize the importance of having two different cultures, two different worlds, and you just kind of bring them both of them together. And the reason why I say that is because I've got a lot of friends who are from London, and they, you know, live like their own cultured life in London, like in, you know, being part of that bubble. But then they're from, you know, West African descent, you know, Nigerian, Ghana, or even Caribbean descent. So they also kind of manage the two. Mm-hmm. But like being from Liverpool, it's just great because it just feels like there's an extra good layer there.
Yeah.
As opposed to just being like an average Southern softie. No offense. No offense.
No, it's fine. There's a reason I came here. But thanks, brother. But thinking about Liverpool sports at the moment, I mean, it's almost never been as good. If you think about the likes of Nikita and the Kat, Natasha at the top of the world right now, you've still got, obviously, got Kat. Mm-hmm. Then you had someone like Tony Bellew, who's turned his career into like a business, massive empire. You've got like Trent, who's coming through at Liverpool now. This is kind of like I can't remember a time when there's been so many fantastic sports people in the range of sports coming through in Liverpool.
Yeah, there definitely is. I guess I've just always been so proud to be from that era, because previously in the beginning, it was obviously like it was either Liverpool FC or Everton FC, and no one really got a look in, which is understandable. I get that. But now you're actually seeing a lot of depth of a lot of, you know, different elite athletes from the city, from a range of different sports. Like Liverpool's always had a massive boxing heritage.
Yes.
That's always been huge. But when I see the girls and the women who've come through, so when I won my Olympic medal, for example, Bianca Walgden,
yes,
who's a taekwondo, like I'd never met her before. I'd heard about her. And then when I'd always see her at the village, it was like nice to be around another Scouser. So the fact that like we won our medals on the same day and then we were doing press for the next 10 hours together, along with some of the other members of the team who also medaled. And then just to be recognised by your city for what you do. And then even last year, so during the Tokyo Games, I unveiled the wall. So there was a mural wall down by the Baltic.
Yes.
As part of Team GB, they had highlighting some of the stars for the Tokyo Games that was happening. And I'm just like, wow, look at Bianca on this wall. Like, it's just incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm honestly just extremely proud. And I was so happy for this to come away as well with another Olympic medal. So yeah, there's just this range in the city, and there's a lot more to come.
I mean, I didn't even mention Paddy O'Molly at the
moment. Oh gosh,
of course, who are taking over the world. But I think back to you as that young Liverpool Harrier, looking up to Diane Allegreen and also Denise Lewis, and just thinking about the kids of Liverpool at the moment, who've got so much inspiration to go on, and they can do pretty much any sport they want to, and they can see one of their heroes there.
Yeah, I definitely think so. You know, I had. Very fortunately to have Denise, who I'd grown up with and watch on TV. And then I also had Diana Green, who was massively influential. You know, we went to the same school, shout out Archbishop Blanche. And then everyone was just like, are you going to break her records? Are you going to break her records? And I was like, I don't know, you know, I don't know if I'm good enough. And even Diane would say, Annika, you're good enough to break the record. So when we had, you know, school sports day or like awards night, Diane would come in and present the medals. And she was like this goddess, like this Amazon goddess. I was like, oh my gosh. And then like only a few years later, we were on teams together. So it's just, that just transitioning from that, from, you know, being just a young girl to then coming up the ranks, to then being on teams together at senior level was just, it was kind of written.
Yeah, and like we say, hopefully there's plenty of inspiration for kids these days.
Definitely.
So let's talk about Liverpool, the club.
Yes.
Now, like myself, you were born in the year the Liverpool won the European Cup. So there's a certain amount of destiny about you being a fan. But again, this is something that was largely influenced by your dad. I want to ask you, was there anybody who tried to sway you to the other side?
Absolutely not. There was no way. There was absolutely none. So half my family split. So some of my siblings support Everton for whatever reason whatsoever. And then obviously, like, the good side is Liverpool. And I'm on the good side. So, my dad would always watch, like, Liverpool games on TV. If it wasn't taking me, he'd take one of the siblings every so often to, like, a game. Mm-hmm. As I got older, I just, The football culture in Liverpool is mad. The Liverpool culture is next level. It really, really is. And even now that I'm back home, like just going to like the last couple of games this season, it's just been mad. So just like watch. It's like, I hadn't been able to do it consistently because I was always traveling. I was away from home.
Yeah.
I left Liverpool like over like 12, 13 years ago. So it's a long time since I've been back. But now that I'm here, like any opportunity I get, I try to go to as many games as possible.
I was thinking that actually, because I mean, your kind of retirement from athletics coincided with Liverpool becoming really good and winning lots of trophies. So, I mean, surely you must be really looking forward to and excited about the idea of actually getting to these things. Because I imagine following Liverpool while you were being an athlete must have been quite difficult. Because, like, obviously your season, your main season's in the summer when there's no football. But it's not like you're doing nothing in the winter, as we've already gone through.
No, not at all, not at all. I'm just in awe of all sports people. It doesn't matter what you do or how far your journey looks. I know what it takes to get there. And, you know, our sports aren't really that different. I mean, our sport's a little bit more glamorous. But I have a lot of love for football, especially Liverpool Football Club. And I've actually got like, I don't know if I wrote this in a book about the story about how I turned up to Anfield with my Olympic medal.
No.
Did I tell that? And I can't even remember. Okay, so basically, right. So when we won the Olympic medal in Rio, I was literally up. I only got like 2-3 hours sleep. And then we had like a 6 o'clock call with all the rest of the athletes to do like press and media because of the time difference. So we were doing it nonstop. And it was great. It was actually really good fun because it's just like, oh, you just immerse yourself in this. But after you've done the first two, I'm just like, nah, I just need to sleep. But you can't. So it's just drinking copious amounts of coffee. You're doing global news, global media, all of that stuff. And one of the last interviews we did was for the BBC, and it was with Mark Chapman. And we weren't in the studio, but we were outside the stadium. I think it was the final gold medal match with NBA, with the Team USA and whoever they were playing in the final, maybe Argentina or Spain or someone. So we were filming outside there. But in the middle of this interview, like live, I was just focused on Liverpool's opening game. That's all I was focused on. That's it. So in the middle of the interview, he's asking me a question. And I must have said something. And again, I was delirious because I was tired. And I'm just like, yeah, it was a great race. And, you know, I'm just so happy for the girls. Shout out to Liverpool FC. I can't wait to see you guys kill it this season. Like, let's bring this trophy home. I'm trying to watch the match right now. Again, I was delirious. I had no idea what I was talking about.
So wait, summer 16. So would that have been the Arsenal game?
Yeah.
The Sadio Mane?
Yes, yes. Oh. So after that, right, after that game, the club contact me.
After the international shout out.
So Liverpool Football Club contact me and they're like, hi Annika, you know, we saw you gave us a big shout out on TV. Congratulations on all your success. We can't wait to see you home. We'd love to invite you to like the next game that you can get to. And then, you know, you get to get your medal and you know, show it around the crowd and all this. When I read that message, I was like, this is a joke. I'm like, is this a verified account? Like, is this the real club? Who is this? This is a setup. And I think I responded with, are you joking? Because no, I need proof. I need proof. Please send me proof. But it was real. So it was someone from the comms team. They, you know, then they organized it through my agent. And yeah, like when the season finished, like 2-3 weeks later, I went to the club and I had the best time. Me and my brother, he went because you could invite a plus one, sit in the box. And we were there early. Like my brother was more excited than I was. Shout out to Chiz. He was excited. He was like, what am I going to wear, kid? Like, do I wear a suit? Do I go casual? And I'm like, bro, wear whatever you want. And he's like, no, I'm going to wear a suit. We didn't need to be at the stadium until like 11. He was up since 6:30. That's how excited he was. Really. So then, we had the great day. And then also, because I mentioned in the interview as well that I did, I'm a massive fan of like, oh, my off-season treat was chicken and waffles at the time. So when they were serving us food, the chef came out with chicken and waffles.
See, like that's the kind of extra detail that I love. And it, the fact that they really took care of you.
No, they really did. They really did. And yeah, and just seeing Klopp, meeting Klopp, and with some of the other players as well. Like, he was like, oh my gosh, I saw you compete. Like, congratulations. And I'm like, is this real?
Now, you've had some experience of coaches, and I mean, some of them were quite eccentric, if the books to be believed. What do you reckon Klopp would have been like as an athletics coach?
I think he would have been great. I think he would have been amazing. Like, I wish we had someone like him. You know, you can just tell the certain football clubs, sorry, the certain individual managers who make an impact or they don't. So take Mourinho, for example. Like, he's just a legend, isn't he? So you either love him or hate him, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But he knows, for the most part, he's good at getting the job right. Whereas someone like Klopp, if he was to be, like, head of performance or head of sport, that would just, that would have been a dream. It's still not too late, but obviously,
he's kind of busy.
Yeah, he's a little bit busy. Yeah. He is a little bit busy. But yeah, he's just an incredible person and, like, a great coach. And I think Liverpool are so lucky to have him.
Oh, definitely. Let's talk about you as a fan then, because I'm fascinated about this. As athletes, as elite sports people, you know what it takes, as you mentioned before. You know some of the things that can be going on in the background of anyone. Does that make you a more sympathetic fan, or are you just likely to scream like an idiot like the rest of us?
I would probably say both. So when we won the Champions League in 2005, that was heart-wrenching, because it's like, because I'd never seen anything like it. There was nothing. I'd never seen anything like it in all the years that I've, you know, followed football since I was a kid. But the fact that it was like Liverpool Football Club to have done that, of course, why not? You know, just penalties and all of that, you know? So yeah, that was incredible. But like, I can definitely empathize with them 100%. You know, just seeing how the players perform, you're not always going to get it right. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to give yourself time to heal and then like mentally get ready again to go for the next game or to go to the next tournament. It's not always going to go your way. And you just got to accept that. But it shouldn't make you feel like you're defeated, like you've just lost everything. You just get ready and go again for the next time. And you also learn a lot from failure. So you fail more than you win. And I definitely went through that throughout my whole career. You learn from the objectives of failure, and you understand what that feeling's like, and you know you never want to go through that again. So what is it going to take? So whether you're doing it as an individual athlete or whether it's you being part of a team, you just don't want to be in that position again.
No, that's interesting, actually. I never thought of it that way. So think about some of the disappointments of the team. So, for example, last season, the way the last season ended, was that something that you were able to relate back to your own career and just think about, okay, well, we didn't get what we wanted. We got so close to our main objective, but there's still plenty of positives to take from the journey that got us there. So
100%. Like, Liverpool being so close to winning the league after that up and down season, that bit that was up and down for those couple of weeks and months, it was like, what is going on? And then the way it happened, you know, on the last day on that Sunday. And then, you know, we won the FA Cup, which is great, which is, like, amazing. And then, you know, the Champions League final. Yes, that was heartbreaking. But, again, that's okay. Like, you just that is just part of your career. It's part of just going through the motions as an athlete, as a team. But it's also how you pick yourself up and bounce back from that. Like I say, failure is part of it. Obviously, you want to avoid failure as much as you can. We all want to win. But for the moments that we're not going to be able to win, it's how you pick yourself up from it. So,
We've had to do a bit of picking ourselves up this season as well. Are you confident about being able to have a better second half and finishing with a bit of silverware, maybe top four, definitely?
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible. It's not impossible. A lot can happen between now and, you know, when the players return from the World Cup. But it's not just Liverpool, it's all the other clubs as well that are having to deal with it and manage it. And you have to be able to manage expectations for yourself as an individual player, but also the club. Because, again, not everyone went away to compete internationally at the World Cup tournament. But there are some players who will walk away from the game disappointed, like Darwin. You know, there's a couple of players who will want revenge and redemption, and we're better to do that than the best club on earth.
Very true, very true. I'm fascinated by Darwin. I can just imagine him in a call room at the Olympics being the worst possible person to be there, because he just would not sit still.
No, he won't. He won't. He'd be one of those pacing up and down. I would probably have to knock him out to be like, can you just stop, please? Like, do we need to hold hands? Like, let's just stop. Like, stop pacing. Just keep still. But he does seem really sweet, though.
Yeah. Like, I think you could probably talk him round.
Yeah, I think I would.
Although, maybe not too much based on previous coverage. We could talk all day.
Yes.
I feel like I've already spoken for too long. But there is one more question I wanted to ask you. What's next? Is it going to be another book? I've heard you spoken previously about wanting to maybe get into administration or coaching or something to basically help the next generation of athletes get into where they need to be. Do you have a plan, or are you just kind of still enjoying where you are at the moment?
I would definitely say a bit of both. So I'm enjoying where I am, because I never really had a moment where I could just take stock of everything and enjoy it. Whereas I feel like I'm actually enjoying it now. Mm-hmm. So whenever I was winning the global medals, I never got time to just relax and just think, oh yeah, this is it. Like, enjoy the moment. It was always, okay, you move on to the next one. And again, it comes with imposter syndrome, or people telling you you're not good enough. Like, it was a fluke, all of that stuff. Yeah. Whereas now I don't care about none of that. Like, I'm enjoying it all. And I definitely don't want to go through what I went through for the next 30 years in book number two, but I do have some opportunities that are potentially coming in 2023.
Okay.
One of them may be related to Liverpool Football Club. Maybe, we'll see.
Okay.
We shall see. But I am excited, because in this next chapter, I'm extremely ambitious. That's why, like, I've got to the point where I am in my career, in my life, mm-hmm. where I'm just so ambitious, I'm so driven. And, you know, even if I fail at whatever it is I fail at, I just want to be able to just be like, okay, you know, let's park that and move on to the next. And I love that. And the fact that I've got potential opportunities, again, in administration, sitting on boards, being part of the change, that's definitely something mm-hmm. that I definitely want to do. And I'm so, so eager to do, because you don't really see people like me doing that, and I feel like I've got all the credentials. It's just about making it happen. So watch this space.
Well, anyone who's read the book, anyone who's listened to you speak about any subjects will know that you've got what it takes to lead people and to get people behind what it is you want to do. So I have all the faith in the world that you can
Thank
go out
you.
And do whatever it is you would do. And if it's a job at Liverpool Football Club, how about your boy? That's what I'm saying. And thank you so much for coming in. It's
thank
been
you.
A wonderful time. I hope everyone out there listening has enjoyed it. That's been the Anfield Wrap.
Thank you. Sports Social Podcast Network.